I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network. If you didn't know by now, we love doing shows on great American presidents. And so we continue that tradition that's gone on for many a year now with an examination of George Washington, and specifically George Washington's farewell address to the nation. That's George Washington's farewell, the Founding Fathers' Warning to Future Generations, is a book just published by John Avlon, and John is our guest this hour. He's editor-in-chief of The Daily Beast. He is a CNN political analyst, author of Independent Nation and Wingnuts, as well as editor of the anthology Deadline Artists, America's Greatest Newspaper Columns. He's won the National Society of Newspaper Columnists Award for Best Online Column in 2012. This book is an interesting one. Washington's Farewell evidently used to be studied and recited by students for years and years and years. Abraham Lincoln, he reminds us, quoted the farewell in defense of the Union. After the Civil War, the farewell was required reading. It was taught in schools and recited in public on Washington's birthday, but then it fell out of favor. And so maybe now with this book, it will be in favor once again. The book also writes a whole lot about Alexander Hamilton and Thomas Jefferson and James Madison and other founding fathers, and gives us glimpses into who this man, George Washington, was. So we're going to welcome your phone calls as we carry along here. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook is The Kathleen Dunn Show, and Twitter is @KDunnShow. John, hello. Thank you very much for being with us.
It's great to be with you. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, it's great that you wrote the book, too. I love doing shows about presidents. Before we talk about the farewell address, let's just spend some time talking about George Washington, because he was an interesting guy. He didn't have very much to say. He didn't have very many teeth. He didn't like to speak all that much, I guess. And yet he's, you know, the head of the revolution, and he's the first president of the nation. Was it just because people respected him because he oozed honesty and sincerity? What was it about him?
Well, it was certainly his focus on cultivating his character. He was acutely aware of the fact that everything he did as president created a precedent, and that he believed in leading by example. And certainly, you know, his role as the general of the victorious army that won the revolution, that solidified his stature and has directly led to him becoming the first president. But what I don't think we adequately appreciate today is Washington's wisdom. Mm. Presidents like Abraham Lincoln are very relatable in their way, and Washington seems distant. But I think that's in part because we put him on such a pedestal, and then we do ourselves a disservice when we do that, because it makes the wisdom less accessible. But his is a fascinating story of a surveyor, a soldier, a statesman, an entrepreneur, and someone who was relentlessly focused on the cultivation of his character, and he was trying to build the character of the nation at the same time.
And you have to, and I felt this so deeply in reading your book, that this nation had just, it was precarious, right? He had to be strong and be just the guy you described, because there were fears that this experiment in democracy wasn't going to last.
It was far from certain, and I'll go further than that. I mean, you know, Washington writes his farewell address 20 years, only 20 years after the Declaration of Independence. And every smart money in continental Europe believed that the American experiment would fail as every other democratic republic had failed. This was an audacious act of hope, and Washington's goal and vision was consistently trying to balance realism and idealism. He was not a president of a party. He was an independent president. He didn't believe in political parties, and he really understood that we needed to walk a middle line between monarchy and the mob, that tyranny and anarchy were always intertwined, and that the forces of history that had destroyed democratic republics in the past, that those were things we needed to recognize and then plan against to mitigate that danger. And that was the real substance of his farewell address. He was writing a memo to future generations about the forces he felt could destroy our democratic republic. And the warnings are incredibly prescient and relevant today.
They certainly are. Do you have your book in front of you?
I don't, but I can grab one off the shelf here.
Oh, would you please?
Sure.
Okay, because I wanted you to read a little something. I haven't read very many first-person, they were there at the time, descriptions of George Washington, and I found, and I want you to tell us a little bit more about her, Henrietta Liston, the wife of the British ambassador, and they were evidently very good friends. And she writes this description of George Washington, which I found to be very meaningful. I think it was probably pretty accurate. Can you tell us about her and what she said about him? It's on page 51.
Page 51. So Henrietta Liston is a fascinating figure because she is the wife of the British ambassador, fairly soon after the Revolution. And Washington was very focused on the idea that, obviously he led a war against the British, but he tried very hard not to let his feelings about the crown and the redcoats collide with his perceptions of the people. And he was very close to Henrietta Liston, and often she was selected to sit next to him at these state dinners, which were informal, certainly, by today's standards. And she was apparently a delightful companion, and Washington enjoyed the company of attractive women. He loved dancing, and he seemed to be charmed by her. And so in her letters, you get a real sense of Washington the man, and that's part of the challenge when you're writing about Washington. It's difficult to get behind the mask
of command. I imagine, right.
Whereas Lincoln, it's, his soul is relatively close to the surface. But the you said page 51?
Page 51. It's her description of him. Naturally grave and silent. I think it's 51, isn't it?
Do you have a hardcover in front of you? Because
I do, yeah. Did I write down the wrong page?
Maybe.
Oh, please. Oh, darn. You're right. I wrote down the wrong page.
It's okay. I think it's 53.
Sorry.
Okay.
Yes, there we go. I'm sorry.
All right. Naturally grave and silent, his mode of life had rendered him frugal and temperate. Vanity in him was a very limited passion, and prudence was his striking trait. Most people say and do too much. Washington, partly from constitutional taciturnity, but still more from natural sagacity and careful observation, never fell into this common error. Nature had been liberal to him. To a majestic figure was added a native unaffected gracefulness of deportment and dignity of manner, which was rather improved by liking, I still will not say a fondness, for dress. Though neither a man of learning nor much acquired knowledge, he possessed not only great good sense and a sound judgment, but was a man of observation and deep reflection. Naturally hot-tempered, cold-hearted, and guarded, he acquired a uniform command over his passions on public occasions, but in private, and particularly with his servants, its violence sometimes broke out. His countenance was peculiarly pleasant when he laughed, which he apparently did with good humor at the jests of others, and he told his own occasionally with gaiety. But it was a flash of a moment. Gaiety was not natural to him. He rose at all seasons early. It was his constant practice to reply to every letter he received, whether the contents were more or less important, agreeable, or otherwise. His first and last pleasure appeared to be farming. On that theme, he always talked freely, and on being on other topics, extremely cautious not to commit himself, and never spoke on any subject on which he was not master.
I think that's really a very perceptive writing about who he was. He really wanted to be a farmer, right? I mean, this thing runs through it. Come on, George, we need you. You've got to lead the revolution. George, we need you to be president. George, you've got to run again. It's like you can see people pulling his arm. You just can't go back to the farm, George.
Well, his modesty ensured his greatness. I mean, when he left command of the Continental Army after the war, George III, King George III in Britain, got word of it. And he is said to have remarked, if he does that, he'll be the greatest man in the world. Because nobody in the history of revolutions relinquished power once they achieved it. I mean, the common pattern was, a revolutionary leader rose up, against tyranny, led a military, and then eventually became a tyrant himself. The key quote, I think, of the entire book, and really to understand this moment and this man, was actually provided by Thomas Jefferson, who's sort of a frenemy of Washington in the grand scheme of things. But he wrote it, and it's the epigraph to the book. The moderation and virtue of a single character probably prevented this revolution from being closed, as most others have been, by a subversion of the liberty it was intended to establish. Moderation and virtue. And so when he retires from the army, and the classical parallel of Cincinnatus, it increases people's respect for him because he seems that he is above He's not driven by lust for power. He's above politics. And that's what makes him the man who can unite the nation after the failures of the Articles of Confederation.
Interesting. And yet it really appears that he was a reluctant president. I was interested, I didn't know this, that he was crafting his farewell address during his first term in office.
Well, that's exactly right. He wanted to retire after one term. He wanted to go home to Mount Vernon. He was the least formally educated of all the founding fathers, and he was acutely aware of that and felt a degree of insecurity about it, particularly on subjects like law and finance. You know, on military matters and farming, he could go on for hours. But he was tired. He was deeply discouraged by the rise of partisan politics, which he sought to contain. It caused him particular pain that his two most talented surrogate sons in the cabinet, Jefferson and Hamilton, hated each other and were scheming to create political parties and fighting in the press. And he wanted to retire, so he asked James Madison, his closest aide at the time, to help him draft a farewell address. And a draft was handed in, but Madison said, "You can't do it." And ultimately, one thing that Jefferson and Hamilton could agree upon was that if Washington resigned, the nation would probably descend into a civil war. We needed more time under Washington's leadership to strengthen as a nation. And so he reluctantly agreed to take another term in office.
Mm-hmm. Another casualty of the partisan divide you just mentioned was his friendship with Thomas Paine.
Yes. Yeah. That's one of the fascinating casualties. And you know, the drama behind the Founding Fathers is really extraordinary if we are determined to view them as people in full, you know, with strengths and weaknesses. And Tom Paine, the great pamphleteer who'd written Common Sense, really inspired the troops. It inspired Washington. Washington ordered that some of his pamphlets be read at Valley Forge to help give his men courage before the Battle of Trenton. But Tom Paine fell into a trap that Jefferson and Madison did as well, which is he got swept up in the alleged idealism of the French Revolution, which was supposedly an extension of the Empire of Liberty. And all three of those men started making ornate excuses for the barbarism which was occurring in liberty's name. And they stuck with the revolution long after it was revealed to be simply a new form of tyranny, heads being cut off at the rate of one a minute in the streets of Paris. And Washington was very skeptical at the outset about the lurchings of the revolution because, as I said earlier, he understood that tyranny and anarchy were intimately connected. The danger of veering into anarchy was that tyranny would soon take its place. Certainly that's what the French Revolution ultimately found with Napoleon Bonaparte. And Tom Paine, when Washington insisted on a proclamation of neutrality between England and France, Tom Paine turned on him viciously and accused him of being a Caesar, a Cromwell, an impostor, no real friend of liberty, in very cutting personal terms. Until Tom Paine was turned on by the revolution and thrown into prison by Robespierre, which he, like many of the apologists for the French Revolution, meekly found his way back to the United States. But that friendship, that great friendship, was permanently ruptured. And ultimately, patterns that were not dissimilar ultimately ruptured Washington's friendships with Madison and Jefferson as well.
Mm. And tell me about the press. Some of the book deals with the press, which bothered Washington. He didn't get totally favorable press, did he?
Not at all.
Not at all.
No, there's a chapter in the book called Hating George Washington, which is just a recounting of the vicious attacks he came under. And look, he was accustomed to being treated with the respect of a general on a battlefield. And one of the reasons he was a reluctant president was he was reluctant to risk his reputation, not only because of failure, but because he knew that it would be attacked for people for partisan reasons. And he bitterly resented it. You know, it's worth remembering that the Constitution doesn't mention political parties. It does mention journalists, however. And Washington understood that a free press was a necessary guarantor of freedom in a democracy. He was perhaps a little bit less tolerant of extreme dissent than Thomas Jefferson was, who, for all his duplicity with regards to George Washington, expressed in the press, one thing Jefferson was consistent about was that he understood that dissent really was essential to democracy and should never be condemned. But the rise of partisan papers, there were around 100 papers at the time, and There was a paper in Philadelphia which was sort of slavishly devoted to the administration that Alexander Hamilton would contribute to on a regular basis. And Jefferson and Madison and Hamilton soon fell into a really bitter personal and political and policy feud. And Jefferson and Madison came up to New York and convinced a college classmate of Madison's named Philip Freneau to come down and be the editor of a paper whose sole purpose would be to attack the administration, particularly the policies of Hamilton. And Freneau said, well, you know, it's really not enough money. And Jefferson said, no problem. I'll hire you to be a clerk in the State Department. So the Secretary of State and a clerk in his department were running a newspaper whose purpose was to attack the policies of the administration
in
which
gosh.
They served.
Oh, my.
It's unbelievable.
It is.
And when Washington confronted him about it, he lied and said, oh, I have no idea. I have nothing to do with this paper. But Washington really was wounded by the attacks and the back and forth. But Hamilton and Madison particularly would suit up and write these increasingly vicious opposing diatribes under the pen names of Roman statesmen. And Washington really felt that those slanders acutely. He really did. It wounded him.
The guy who was closest to him was Hamilton?
Yes. Yes. And you know, you've got to appreciate that their relationship is formed in the crucible of the war. Hamilton begins as an aide-de-camp. He's doing correspondence, basically a speechwriter, but ends up becoming his chief of staff. And even though they had a contentious relationship of time, they were both hot-tempered and proud, that one of the things that happened during the war is they started to have similar philosophical views. For example, the Continental Congress was largely incompetent. It was not powerful enough. It was not strong enough. And the loyalties to each of the individual states outweighed their focus on actually winning the war. They weren't coughing up enough cash to support the army, for example. And debt was a real problem. The army wasn't being supplied with weapons, bullets, shoes, basic necessities. And out of that came, for both Washington and Hamilton, a belief in the need for a strong, energetic central government and the need for fiscal discipline, for fiscal responsibility, which meant paying taxes. And so out of that crucible came their relationship. Certainly in the administration, Hamilton, as Treasury Secretary, basically also functioned as Chief of Staff. Enormously influential in terms of policies that set America off, and of course, and those policies were bitterly opposed for being too based on the British system by Jefferson and Madison. But when Washington realized that Jefferson and Madison were behind the partisan intrigues and behind the newspapers that were attacking him and his administration, he ultimately broke with them. And even though Hamilton had retired, when it came time to do the second farewell address, Washington took the Madison draft, sent it to Hamilton in New York, and they really worked on it together. And while the words are largely Hamilton's, the ideas are all Washington's. And it's kind of poetic that at the very end he insisted that John Jay provide another edit. So Washington was actually getting the band back together, the Federalist Papers brothers. Hamilton, Madison, and Jay all had a hand in Washington's farewell address. And I think that speaks to how he was consciously trying to create a document beyond partisanship.
Interesting. And I'm wondering how much of the document, I didn't realize this, you remind us in the book that the Founding Fathers had a fascination with ancient Greece and Rome, and they were concerned about the forces that brought down past republics. The history of the decline and fall of the Roman Empire was a contemporary bestseller.
Yes.
So did Washington read that thoroughly? Do you find elements of that work in his farewell address?
Certainly he was aware of it. There is a copy in his library. But we know certainly that Madison and Hamilton were obsessed, and that's not too strong a word, all the Founding Fathers were, with classical Rome and Greece and the cautionary tales that emerged from it. It's a profound thing because you realize how focused the Founding Fathers were on history and learning from history,
mm-hmm.
Particularly learning from the mistakes of history to correct them. But this was very much top of mind, the forces that could topple empires, civilizations, particularly democratic republics. And that's why Washington called out the dangers of hyperpartisanship. History showed that these self-interested political factions would hijack a government, would distract people from the national interest, and that would lead to such a deadlocked democracy that frustrated citizens would grow disgusted with inefficiency and ineffectiveness, and that would ultimately open the door to a demagogue with authoritarian ambitions. That's what Washington warned about. And that was a constant theme, and it was rooted in examples in classical Greece and Rome. The same thing about his warning about foreign wars and the dangers of foreign influence in domestic politics. When I was writing the book, I could not have appreciated how relevant that would become. But Washington spends an enormous amount of time warning that foreign powers would try to come and influence and interfere with our domestic politics, and that would ultimately, with the goal of undermining our sovereignty. And certainly that has resonance with what Russia tried to do. Vladimir Putin didn't make up that playbook all on his own. Right. But it's something that Washington was acutely aware of.
Well, we're going to welcome phone calls. We're talking about George Washington this hour, and especially his farewell address. John Avlon is our guest. He is the author of Washington's Farewell, The Founding Fathers' Warning to Future Generations. Many of you will be familiar with John. He is a CNN political analyst. He's editor-in-chief of The Daily Beast. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. We have some lines open for you at this very moment, 800-486-8655. Email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook, The Kathleen Dunn Show. This is the Ideas Network. We go to phone calls and messages for John, 800-486-8655. First email is from Gary, who wants you to tell him, do you know if Washington was at all involved in the creation of the Electoral College?
I mean, to the extent that he was president of the Constitutional Convention, yes. But, you know, he really did try to preside over those proceedings without speaking a great deal. It was his presence was powerful enough, because more than half the members of the Constitutional Convention had served under him in war. And incidentally, the average age of the delegate was 42. But you know, he did not roll up his sleeves and get involved in high degrees of minutia. What he tried to do was, after the conventions had closed for the day, people retired to the local taverns, he would roll his sleeves up and he would try to reconcile opposing points of view, and to try to forge common ground. One fascinating thing is, even before there were political parties, we see some very deep divides that have persisted in American politics that are still there. We had people focused on national unity, a strong, energetic central government, and they tended, but not always, to be from more urban areas. And then you had folks who were more identified with their states. They were focused on states' rights. They were very concerned about the encroachment of federal power on their way of life, particularly economic and cultural. And both sides felt they were fighting for freedom. And what Washington tried to do was reconcile the two as much as possible.
Could I ask you just, I really love dogs, and the last presidential show we did actually was on John Quincy Adams, and I was struck in that book, we had him on a couple weeks ago, the author, that John Quincy Adams was tasked with the delivery of 7 dogs to George Washington. He had to take these dogs across the Atlantic on a harrowing journey. And then, lo and behold, I read in your book about George Washington's dogs.
Yes.
And the names of the dogs. And I was just thinking, well, by golly, I wonder if those were the dogs that John Quincy Adams brought across the ocean. So I had to ask you that.
That's a great question. The dogs of the era in which I'm describing are right after the Revolutionary War. And I do not know if Quincy would have been traveling across the ocean at that time. He was a very active member of the Foreign Service under President Washington, and someone who Washington really respected as a leading light of the next generation. But the names of the dogs, I thought, gave such a wonderful insight into the human Washington, which we don't see enough, right? You know,
right.
He seems so, stern and distended, but the names of his dogs are Sweet Lips, True Love, Drunkard, Music, Mopsy, and Vulcan. I love it. He had dogs named Drunkard and Mopsy. You can imagine George Washington tromping across a field calling for Drunkard and Mopsy. And it really humanizes him in a wonderful way.
It does indeed. All right, let's go to Charlie in Milwaukee. Hello, Charlie.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
One of the things that always struck me interesting about George Washington is that I think he was 44 when he took over the Continental Army in 1776, And the part that is interesting is that at the time, he's one of the wealthiest, if not the wealthiest man in the colonies.
Ah.
If he got caught, he would have been drawn and quartered as a traitor. His family would have been obviously ostracized if the war had been lost, and they would have lost all their property and everything because he was a traitor. And at the same time, the life expectancy for a male in the colonies was about 40 to 45. So he wasn't doing this with some long-term benefit. He was doing this truly because he believed in the right, in liberty. He truly believed in what he was doing, and he was willing to put it all on the line. And that is something that we have to remember when people don't vote, or when people aren't discussing the politics in a civilized way. People need to remember that George Washington put everything on the line for our democracy, and it's just something people don't really think about very much.
Thanks, Charlie. Okay, thanks for the call, John.
It's such an important point. Remember the last line of the Declaration of Independence. They swore their lives, I believe, treasure and sacred honor. They were putting everything on the line, not just George Washington, although certainly he would have been killed if caught. But they all did. And that's the proper perspective to consider, you know, the birthright of democracy and liberty. And interestingly, you know, the Founding Fathers used the word liberty a lot. And we use liberty kind of interchangeably with freedom and independence. But for them, there was a very subtle but important difference. Freedom can be a state of nature, but liberty requires a degree of self-discipline. And that's what self-government asks of us. And a big part of what Washington was warning future generations about, warning us about, was that democracy and liberty were not a given, that they needed to be maintained and strengthened by each generation. And that meant not simply sliding into licentiousness or taking these things for granted, but they really must be appreciated in a spirit of generational responsibility and handed down. And that's one of the reasons why we really need to learn the old stories and treasure the old documents and invest again in civic education, because this is our sacred trust. And if we treat it disrespectfully, there's no guarantee that it continues. And that's what it requires of us. It's not much, but we need to take the responsibility of self-government seriously.
Absolutely. Couldn't be more in agreement with you. When he talks about peace through strength in this farewell address, what does that mean in his time? And what would it mean, do you think, in our time, if we can ask him to go ahead a few hundred years?
Well, peace through strength is really a core part of his foreign policy prescription. You know, Washington's farewell address has been, I think, willfully misinterpreted as an endorsement of isolationism in the past by folks, and it's really not. Washington wanted to propose a foreign policy of independence. But really, you can reduce his entire political philosophy to a philosophy of independence. He wanted America to be strong economically and militarily so that we wouldn't that we could be self-sufficient, that we wouldn't be easily conquered or fall into being a satellite of another power with their own interests. And the ancient Roman dictum, peace through strength, he updated and extended in his speech to Congress. He really understood, as a soldier does, that often that preparing for war is the most sure means of securing peace, because you don't invite aggression with weakness. And I think there are a lot of folks who continue that view today. Washington hated war and the waste of war in blood and treasure, as really perhaps only soldiers can. And you know, I think he would have been appalled by the idea that we would cut taxes in the middle of a war. It is a sacrifice for all and should be engaged only in extreme circumstances that involve our national self-interest very clearly. But he was very focused on the idea of peace through strength, and it's an extension of his core belief of independence and self-sufficiency as a nation, that we should never be overextended politically, militarily, economically, or in foreign policy. Mm.
Emmanuel in Kenosha. Hi, Emmanuel.
Hi, good afternoon. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I was hoping to have your guest comment a bit more on General Washington's view on respect for other nations' sovereignty. I think in today's world, where everyone seems so offended in our own country with potential Russian interference with the elections and so on, it seems rather hypocritical of us to complain about that when this country has a very long track record of constantly trying to influence and interfere in other nations' sovereign affairs. Mm. I'll take the answer off the air.
All right, thanks, Emmanuel.
Sure. Well, I would say that there's an element to that argument which has been called whataboutism, right? So you raise a point, and then somebody says, well, what about this? The caller is absolutely right that Washington did have an understanding of foreign policy, which was, I think, codified in part by the Monroe Doctrine, that of respecting nations' self-determination, that one of his core points was we should have commercial relations with all nations, we should try to keep friendly and honest and honorable relations with all nations, but we should keep our political connections to a minimum. And that's something that I think reinforces an idea that's sometimes expressed as, you know, a republic, not an empire. And foreign adventures, foreign wars, unnecessary foreign wars that made a country overextended was all something that throughout history, particularly in the Roman Empire, had led to decline. And he would warn against that. In a letter to James Monroe I just pulled up, he wrote, "I have always given it as my decided opinion that no nation had a right to intermeddle in the internal concerns of another, that everyone had a right to form and adopt whatever government they liked best to live under themselves." He also, however, believed that the cause of virtue and liberty is confined to no continent or climate. But he didn't think that we should be imposing democracy at the point of bayonet, maybe to your caller's point. Mm-hmm. But I do think that looking at the mistakes we have made, perhaps when we have extended beyond Washington's advice as a way of, perhaps trying to put in context to be reasonable about attempts to influence our own elections, that falls apart pretty fast for me.
Let's talk about, because we look at these wonderful people who founded this incredible country and their wisdom and their patience and their moderation and their deep thinking and the debt that we have to them through history. And then we try to take on this darned issue of slavery. And there is George Washington with 300 slaves. He got when he married Martha, and two of them ran away, and he was furious about them. But he does release them on his deathbed. It's just hard to reconcile that in 2000. Well, it just seems like it would always be hard to reconcile that. Did he write about slavery? Did he talk about slavery? Did he struggle with it or not?
He did. But he did not mention slavery in the farewell address. For all that he talked about the importance of national unity and passionately embraced religious pluralism and all forms of pluralism and immigration consistent with assimilation and all these things, he sidestepped the issue in the farewell address, I think, dishonorably. He, as you say, became a slave owner when he married Martha. I consider his last will and testament, which I write about in the book too, mm-hmm. as kind of a belated coda to the farewell address, because he addresses incompletely, belatedly, the issue of slavery by trying to set an example on his deathbed, which you can easily say is too little too late and a convenient time to do it, by releasing his slaves. Now, I'll say that the 9 subsequent presidents who owned slaves did not follow that example, and he was clearly trying to set an example. And you see over the course of his life him grow more and more frustrated with the cruel economies of slavery. And he says in a side to Edmund Randolph, who'd been his attorney general, that if there was a civil war, he would go with the North. He wanted to see slavery end. But in the Constitutional Convention, he supported that odious compromise, which was necessary at the time, to table the issue of slavery, because there was no other way they were going to get to a document they could agree upon as a majority of states or a supermajority of states. And I do think it's important, 2 things. One, it's important that we, when we read history, that we don't endlessly project our own values onto the past. It's tempting to do, but I think it confuses the underlying issues, even when there seems to be, and is from our perspective, the self-evident moral clarity. And the other thing we need to do, and I interviewed Lin-Manuel Miranda, who's the playwright and actor in Hamilton, mm-hmm. where there's a whole song about the farewell.
We're going to play some of it.
Oh, cool.
I know, cool.
But Lin-Manuel made the point, which I think also is relevant, which was we need to acknowledge and embrace the contradictions. That this is a man who spoke eloquently about freedom while owning other human beings. You can't shy away from it. You need to confront it. You need to deal with it. But the contradiction is there. And Washington was more tortured by slavery than is often recognized. And he tried to do the right thing to some extent at the very end. But I fully understand that certainly to contemporary eyes, and I think to certainly abolitionist eyes at the times, that was too little too late. Mm-hmm. He was trying to set an example.
We'll take more phone calls in a moment. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. John Avlon is our guest. He's editor-in-chief, managing director of The Daily Beast, a CNN political consultant, author most recently of Washington's Farewell, the Founding Fathers' Warning to Future Generations. He has been a columnist and associate editor for the New York Sun, chief speechwriter for Mayor Giuliani, and won the National Society of Newspaper Columnists Award for Best Online Column in 2012. He has written other books as well, including Independent Nation and Wingnuts. So we'll take more phone calls momentarily. We mentioned Hamilton. The farewell address finds its way into Hamilton. Here's just a little clip.
Mr. President, you asked to see me. I know you're busy. What do you need, sir? Sir, I want to give you a word of warning.
Sir, I don't know what you heard, but whatever it is, Jefferson started it.
Thomas Jefferson resigned this morning.
You're kidding.
I need a favor.
Whatever you say, sir, Jefferson will pay for this behavior.
Shh. Talk less.
I'll use the press. I'll write under a pseudonym. You'll see what I can do to him.
I need you to draft an address.
Yes, he resigned. You can finally speak your mind.
No. He's stepping down so he can run for president. Good luck defeating you, sir. I'm stepping down. I'm not running for president.
I'm sorry, what?
One last time. Relax, have a drink with me. One last time. Let's take a break tonight, and then we'll teach him how to say goodbye. To say goodbye, you and I.
Let's go to Raphael in Milwaukee. Hi, Raphael.
Hi there. Thanks for taking my call. My question for your guest, it relates to Washington's warning to future generations as learn from our mistakes so that history doesn't repeat itself. And it does look like it is repeating itself. And I was just wondering what your guest thinks about the possibility that because human nature hasn't changed, that's why we're going to continue to see history repeating itself. And that was just a link that I thought maybe there's a connection there, and I just wanted to hear his opinion.
And Raphael, what are you worrying about repeating itself? What's repeating?
History repeating itself.
Any part of history that you're concerned about? Or?
Oh, he just briefly mentioned that bipartisanism is going to get too strong.
Right.
And eventually people get sick of it. And I can kind of relate to exactly what's going on right now. I feel like that's happening right now.
Gotcha. Yeah, there certainly is more than a little of that going on right now.
Yeah.
Go ahead, John.
I think one of the most urgent things to confront is that Washington warned us about hyperpartisanship, and very often people invoke the Founding Fathers to excuse their hyperpartisanship. But, when government and democracy does get deadlocked, it opens the door to a demagogue, and that's something that we've had some recent experience about with regard to the previous campaign. And so I think in unsettled times, in stormy times, that's precisely when we need to study history, and American history, to root ourselves in first principles and enduring values. Studying history gives us a sense of courage and comfort as we face an uncertain future, because these great figures did too. As the caller points out, those who do not know history are, destined to repeat it. And it's one of the reasons that Washington was so focused on the importance of education, on the importance of an enlightened people. Even though he was the least formally educated founding father, he was really obsessed in later life with starting a national university that could bring people together and override regional discriminations and create a common national culture and arts and letters and industry, all towards the eye of national unity and self-sufficiency. And he understood and said very eloquently that self-government depended upon enlightened opinion. That there's a different burden for citizens of a republic, that we need to be educated, we need to have enlightened opinions in order to really govern ourselves effectively and fairly, and understanding history. The whole project that he embarked upon with Madison and Hamilton was to say, here are the forces that have destroyed democratic republics before. Learn from those dangers, because human nature doesn't change very much. Anticipate them, avoid them. And that's where the we really need to listen again. Hmm. We need to study history. We need to study civics. We need to have enlightened opinion as American citizens.
And is that why you did the book at this time, because you're worried about that yourself?
I mean, I started this book 4 years ago, and there were a lot of things I couldn't anticipate, including two small children. I certainly couldn't have anticipated President Trump, I'll tell you that. But I got the sense that we were at a point in our history where Americans were beginning to think of our country as a civilization and worried that it might be in decline vis-a-vis rising powers like China and India. And at that point, it was really important that here was this great treasure, this wonderful gift given to us by the first founding father that was written for us about these larger forces, and that we needed to heed them. We needed to pay attention, whether it was the dangers of hyperpartisanship, the dangers of excessive debt, the dangers of foreign wars, the importance of national unity and education, religious pluralism, that those were all lessons that we needed on a fundamental level to take heed of again, and that we could use the speech, this great forgotten speech that was once more widely reprinted in the Declaration of Independence, to hold up against the decisions we have to make in our own times, and they could still guide us. And I think the speech does that, and I think we need to do that again. We need a new generation of Washingtonians.
Jake is next in Oshkosh. Hi, Jake.
Hi, good afternoon, Kathleen. I've been listening to the program and the callers' questions and your guests responding to it, particularly the last caller. My question to the guests is, what would you envision to be the practical way of getting back to avoiding all those things that Washington warned us about?
Sure.
What would be one or two or three practical ways?
Sure. Well, I think there are two big things and two specific things I can offer. One, with regard to the larger points Washington made, he was always very clear that the backstop in a democracy when things got off center, when we got overextended in politics or finance or foreign wars, was vigorous citizens. There is no replacement for vigorous citizenship. He didn't want to see political parties, but he recognized that they were probably inevitable. And so he said it's the duty of a wise people to restrain them so that they didn't become so that they didn't start thinking that they were the purpose of our politics, not the national interest. He also was very passionate about the important point of national unity. He understood that our independence as a nation depended upon our interdependence as a people. And he felt very passionately about that. And he warned against those folks who would try to divide us as Americans for selfish reasons, political reasons, economic reasons. He called them pretend patriots. And he warned us to watch out for them. So those are two broad things to keep in mind. With regard to the hyperpartisanship and polarization we've seen, it seems very clear to me that we need to change. You change the rules, you change the game. And we need to end the rigged system of redistricting, and we need to have open primaries. And if we did those two things, members of Congress would have more incentive to find areas of common ground. They'd have more incentive to emulate the founders in finding principled compromise. But now, you know, there are only 35 competitive districts in Congress, so most members are afraid to reach across the aisle and compromise. That increases citizen frustration, and that, you know, opens the door to a demagogue. So I'd say those two broad principles to keep in mind, and those two specific fixes on the issue of partisanship.
And also the issue of civility, for heaven's sake. It has
sure.
to be emulate from the highest office in the country, too. You just can't have people who are leading the country saying the kinds of things that have been said. They're just not kind. No. They're not civil.
No, and Washington you know, that was one of the things in his amazing letters that I excerpt, where he's trying to mediate between Washington, between Hamilton and Jefferson. And he understands they're fighting, and he's begging them to put it aside, to recognize that what they shared is far more than divided them, and the destructive impacts on our government could be so big. But it all boils down to this. Democracy depends upon an assumption of goodwill among fellow citizens.
Mm-hmm.
And we have forgotten that. We have been seduced into the idea that people who disagree with us must be demonized, that they must have America's best interests not at heart. And that's really a cancer on our body politic. That's something we need to address. And Washington had very clear views about the dangers of falling away from that. When we start believing there more than divides us than unites us, even if people are selling that snake oil underneath the umbrella of the American flag, saying they're the true patriots, Washington would have called them pretend patriots. Mm,
interesting. We need to talk just a little bit about the address itself. He didn't stand up in Philadelphia and deliver it on the steps of his house or in the public square. It was in the newspaper.
That's correct. He chose the American Daily Advertiser. There were one of 100 papers in the country. But what's fascinating was he didn't give it to a partisan newspaper. And there were partisan newspapers that had supported him. But he wanted to give it to the American Daily Advertiser because they were notably independent, in part, frankly, because they had congressional printing contracts. But he really did want it not to be the farewell address to be something that was above partisan politics. He wanted to reach all the people. And he wanted to write an open letter to the American people, which he addressed to his friends and fellow citizens, which I think is an eloquent opening that expresses the character of the man and the way he was trying to speak to them eye to eye.
Mm-hmm.
That he didn't want to give a speech in front of Congress like a monarch to Parliament, that he wanted to set a little d, little r, Democratic and Republican example. And so he chose an open letter to the American people in a newspaper, an independent newspaper.
And it was read widely? And how was it how did people react to it?
Oh, it was rapturous. Look, first of all, people forget this is the last revolutionary act. By stepping down from power a second time, he sets up the fact that we really are going to be a democracy. We are not going to drift into monarchy. He sets the two-term precedent, which every president until FDR yes. followed before we did a constitutional amendment to enshrine it. It was part of the unwritten Constitution. And the peaceful transfer of power is something we take for granted, but it was not a given then. But it was the wisdom that he was partaking, and people recognized it right away. They said, hold on to this paper. Keep it. Teach it to your kids. And it really did have this great centrality. I mean, when it was more widely reprinted than the Declaration of Independence. When the War of 1812 came, reprints shot up because people felt uncertain and they wanted to remember the founding's wisdom, even though Washington at that point had been dead for 12 years. When the Civil War came, you know, George Lincoln quoted it in the stump speech and ordered it be read aloud to troops during the war to remind them what they were fighting for. And then after the war, it was mandatory teaching in public schools to reunite the nation. So it had this amazing throw weight. It cast this amazing light on American civic discourse. It was civic scripture. And it's kind of the Old Testament. I write in the book. It's the Old Testament of American politics. It's these rules of behavior dispatched by a distant God. And it's ultimately replaced by the Gettysburg Address's New Testament,
mm-hmm.
which is this poetic rumination on life after death. And it's only 272 words, so it's much easier to memorize in public schools.
So you've brought it back. John, you brought it back for us, didn't you?
Thank you. I tried.
Yeah.
I'm trying. We're fighting the good fight. Spread the word. I appreciate you helping me do that.
Absolutely. Our pleasure. Thank you very much for being with us, and thanks for writing the book. We love doing shows like this. Thanks.
Thank you so much.
John Avlon, the book is Washington's Farewell, the Founding Fathers' Warning to Future Generations. He is the editor-in-chief at the Daily Beast and a CNN political analyst, the author of Independent Nation and Wingnuts, as well as an editor of the anthology Deadline Artists, America's Greatest Newspaper Columns. We thank him for being with us. It's really an interesting book. It goes way beyond the farewell address, but that's the centerpiece of the book as he looks at the partisanship, as he looks at George Washington as a general, as a farmer, as the president, his reluctance to become president and to run again as president, his relationship with Martha, his dogs, his not really shyness, but modesty in not being a terribly well-educated man or much of a speaker, but a thinker, obviously, and who wanted to give his words a lot of thought and distribute them in language that would be understandable by absolutely everybody. So that's the book. Thanks for all of your calls, everyone. We're with you again on Monday. On Monday, we have All Things Political, which is at 1 o'clock on Monday. And we always have really good guests for that from a variety of different political perspectives. So we invite you to join us then. Thanks very much to Scotty Myers for producing the hour and to Colleen Duvall for on-air production here in our Milwaukee studios. Thanks for your interest in history. News is coming up, and thank you for listening.